This episode of the No Film School podcast is sponsored by MusicBed. MusicBed believes everyone should have access to great music in their projects, regardless of their budget or workflow. That's why they just announced their all-new membership program, the first music licensing subscription of its kind, releasing this summer. Membership is here to make their world-class roster of artists and composers available for all of your projects. Membership will give you unlimited access to a majority of MusicBed's artists, all at a flat monthly or yearly rate based on the types of films you make. And if you still want single-use licenses, they're not going anywhere. Membership is just a new option to make licensing work better for your workflow. Be one of the first to learn more at musicbed.com/membership. And don't forget, you can get 20% off your next on-site license with coupon code NF20. This is Oakley Anderson Moore, and you're listening to the No Film School Podcast. If you spent a few hours on a video trying to, say, match one impossibly orange shot to another slightly magenta, you know how aggravating and yet how important color is to a film. Of course, it's more than just matching shots. Color grading is a crucial part of how the world of the story is set. This week on part two of a look into the post-production process, we focus on the mysterious world of colorists. How do you become one? How do you work with one? How does the interplay of RGB affect the overall experience of your film? To answer that and more, here's a conversation featuring some of the most accomplished colorists on the independent film circuit. So let me talk to the colorists for a little bit. So I'd love to hear about, especially, you know, Sam and Nat, you guys have 4 plus 5, you have 9 films between the two of you. You know, can you speak to the choices that you help the director make with color? And what would be kind of interesting is if you can think of like 2 films that had a really different choice, and you can like tell us about that. So like this, you know, if you had 2 films that went in very different directions, I would be curious to hear so that I could understand better how like those choices play out.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to, you're talking about tone, and obviously with color, that's kind of like all we're doing, right? I mean, of course, you know, we're doing the mundane things of matching shots and all that, but you know, hopefully that's not the meat of it. Though what you're doing is setting the tone, and every project is totally different. Surprise, surprise, right?
There's no like one color for Sundance indie film.
Right? Yeah. There's a preset that I've spent a lot of time building, and now that I got it, it's just like it works perfectly. Each filmmaker's approach is really different, and one of the things that I've found can be really great is to start the process as early as possible. It doesn't always work out that way. But a lot of the cinematographers that I work with are people that I've worked with before, not always. There's that piece of that time in pre-production where no one quite knows what's going to emerge, like you guys are talking about, but you're doing things like building lookbooks and talking about inspirations and, you know, what, and kind of trying to imagine what the film might become and looking at other things that you like and what things you don't like. And that piece of time can be super valuable for the colorists to be involved, if it's possible. It's challenging because pre-production things are hectic, and like everyone's running around like crazy people, and like at some level, like, you know, doing elaborate tests and stuff is like the last thing that is on people's minds. They want to like scout locations and like figure out these like very critical things that are in some ways kind of more pressing. But one of the things that I've started doing as much as I can is working in pre-production and working with the cinematographer and director to come up with some ideas about what the film is going to look like, and build like a LUT or whatever to allow the DP to use those looks that we've come up with in camera so that they, as they're shooting, they can be seeing what we've done and expose and do everything accordingly. And also so that then in editorial, they're working with something that has the look that we've collectively envisioned. And that doesn't, that can always change, right? But it's something that I find useful because you can talk about like ideas that you'll implement down the road later. But I've found that, you know, if people spend 6 months working with something that was a preset built by Arri or Sony or Red or whoever, that somehow like becomes ingrained in their mind as like the true thing, right? That's somehow the id of the footage, and that anything else is like something that you're putting on top of it, huh. Right? And the truth of it, of course, is that those things are no more true than anything else, right? So anyway, that was a long-winded way of saying, I found it's great like to start that process really early in the process. If possible, sometimes it's not, and sometimes, sometimes the reverse can be true, which is that a DP shoots something, goes on and shoots a bunch of other projects, hasn't seen anything for 8 months, and comes back with totally fresh eyes, and thinks like, "Oh yeah, you know this. Let's do something totally different. Like now that I see how this has been cut together, like let's not." Do what we were thinking about. There's no rules, I guess. but to the extent that that the color cannot be an afterthought, obviously it is so integral to the tone. From that point of view, it's like, sometimes I think it's great to like have the editors working with stuff that has some piece of the feeling that you're working towards. I occasionally work on projects where the editors are maybe working with like raw log footage or something that's completely different than what the end result will be. And it's puzzling to me because it is such a key piece of the tone, right?
And then they decide to keep it in log. You're like, no.
Yeah, that doesn't usually happen with projects that I'm working on. But totally, yeah.
Well, I mean, this might be a silly question, but how, as a colorist, I mean, you're working, your eye will constantly be adapting. How do you work as a colorist and not just suddenly be like having color, how can you even keep clear what shifts in the color are happening? You know what I mean? From a
still gallery. That's in a scope.
Scopes, so it's all about the scopes.
Always have gallery references to keep you honest, and scopes. So if which can be used for your benefit also. If someone says that a scene is looking a little too magenta, you could say, "Well, look here in the vector scope; it's really not." so that could be your friend. But to go back to what Nat said about getting involved with color in pre-production. I've had a lot of great experiences with that because the same reasons Nat said, you decide on a look. It's usually the DP lights through the look or the LUT that you've created, and the director and editor are used to that so that you're only improving upon it. But it does take away a little bit of discovery. And sometimes, you have to say, well, this is not working now that we see everything put together, and let's push this. Or we've had three blue scenes in a row. Everyone's eyes are going to normalize to blue, and it's not going to feel, you're not going to feel that emotion. Let's get a neutral scene first, and then we can start warming things up as the story time. So when especially when scenes are ordered around, and time of day has changed, you really have to have some flexibility as to how you can change the color and the tone for the edit. And let's see, of the four films that I have in the festival, I was only on pre-production for one, and we changed it completely when we got to the DI. It was a movie called Piercing. I worked with the director, Nick Pesch, before on The Eyes of My Mother, which was here in 2016. And he has a music video background, so he's really gutsy with looks, as we had on Eyes of My Mother. And I showed him a look that I've been playing with called the Lightbox look. And it was just something that I came up with. I was trying to find new looks. I was working on a TV show called The Deuce. And I tried to create a look, and then I realized that it was too much for this show, and we stuck with a period look of mimicking the way transparent photography looks when it's mounted on a light box and shine through it. And I showed it to Nick, and he was all for it. And you know, the DP, Zach Galler, he didn't want to have that look on set. I mean, it didn't make any sense to him. So I modified a look, and it looked great. What he shot looked great. And we get to the DI, and I'm all working with the LUT that we created. And then I accidentally on purpose put the light box on to kind of see how things, and it snapped right in. And Nick and I were looking at each other like, wow, this thing that we threw out months ago as being it was just not right. It all of a sudden, it fit for 90% of the film, and I just had to massage the other 10%. And it's got a really nice, unique look that really fits for the film. And it's something that I just had in my back pocket. And I threw away the LUT that, you know, I had tweaked, you know, months before for production. The other films, a movie called Sorry to Bother You, the DP had his own LUT that he used and he liked. And he was working on a TV show. And he lit through that and it looked good. And then I had some extra time to play with it. The VFX were late to deliver, so I had the material, and I found a whole bunch of stuff that was there that the LUT wasn't showing, and I created a new look, and everybody loved it, and it really fit the piece, and thankfully the director and the DP weren't what we call in temp love, where you just what Nat was saying is like, this is the way the movie looks, and anything too far from that, it feels different. So I was able to find really some new tones for the film and really bring out some of the comedy and some of the satire that you weren't feeling from the production LUT. Seth, do you have anything to add?
We the Animals was interesting because it was shot on Super 16 in red. So we did, they needed to shoot Super 16 because the director wanted that look, and also because of the time period the film takes place. And they also needed to shoot digital because there were a lot of VFX shots. So digital would make the VFX a lot easier. So before they even started shooting, we did camera tests, and we did tests side by side with Super 16 and Red. And we matched the look and the grain between the two. And I did a side by side test, and people couldn't guess which was like pretty exciting to do. And we also dialed in the look, which is to some extent already there for film. Granted, we played around with contrast a bit, but we referenced a lot of photographers like Mary Helena Clark and DeCorsia as well. And we went off of photography references that he had, but we definitely had temp love, or, you know, for when you guys were cutting, we made LUTs. But the director started feeling like, oh, film should be soft, you know. But then when we would go back and look at stills pulled from film, shot on film, they always have a healthy level of contrast. So we wound up, the color grade kind of worked in a pendulum manner to some extent. The DP, Zach Mulligan, sat in before I started working with the director, because that's how his schedule worked out. And we wound up going for a more contrasty look that the DP wanted. But then when Jeremiah came in to look at all that, he was like, whoa, you guys are nuts. This is too contrasty. So we swung back the other way for something lower contrast and softer. But then as the grade went on, we wound up swinging back the other direction a bit with, you know, a little more contrast and color. A lot of the set design influenced the color, of course. The set designer is super important. And Jeremiah and I talked about that before he started shooting. You know, the different palettes he was going to choose, and that the house they shot in was super important. It's an awesome house that they found in Utica, upstate. So that influenced the palette tremendously. So I didn't want to try to destroy anything. You know, I think for color, you don't want to wind up ruining a beautiful set by trying to shoehorn anything. Yeah. So we wanted to, you know, bring all that out in the color. You know, we experimented with a few different things and tweaking things, and there were a lot of shots we had to shoehorn together. And when we had to do that, sometimes we had to make a good shot look a little worse, you know, and to make a bad shot look better and have them cut seamlessly. But the whole process was really rewarding, and Jeremiah was really involved in the look.
Can I bring up one more thing about tone in documentary and yes. music?
Yeah.
Because I think music is really controversial in documentary, and I'd be curious what Keiko has to say about it. And that's something that from the beginning, Jonathan and Alon were like, okay, we want this to be an entertaining film first and foremost, a movie, not like nonfiction, fiction. And so from the beginning, we just were like, we were super clear. We can use $1 million temp scores. We're just going to go for it. And we're going to not worry about, you know, I think a lot of doc filmmakers and editors are nervous about the music over compensating for something or over empowering, or it's supposed to be more like subtle and supportive. Mm-hmm. And in this case, we just did the exact opposite. And we did have like some criticism just from a couple people we showed it to that they're like, oh, your music's just too, it's too much, you know, like, yeah, that's the point. Yes, you know. So I think that was another thing that I think we were playing with and like didn't feel like we needed to be constrained by the way like kind of people think about, even the makers of documentaries think about how to use music. But so just to say that also Troy Harry and the composer took it to a whole nother level. So he had this temp score to play with, and then that had an enormous impact on the overall tone eventually, which I think in documentaries, you know, maybe people don't capitalize on that enough.
The temp love is definitely a huge problem for music, because I think I do pretty good job temping musicing. And so when the composer comes in, or when we have the actual music we can afford, it comes as sometimes as a disappointment. Mm-hmm. So, and
you're like, I like the Philip Glass one better.
Yeah, on Clara's Ghost, we had kind of a mix of the two things, because we were working with this incredible artist, Stella Mazgawa, who is the drummer in the band Warpaint. And she came on very early on in the pre-production process, so we kind of were giving her a heads up of where we wanted to go with the film. And our temp love came from temp tracks that she was sending us as we were cutting. And we started to fall in love with things. And after we found out we were in Sundance and we were trying to wrap up, Stella was in Australia on tour, and she hit some kind of epiphany and sent me about 12 tracks. And I just, my head exploded. Like, I fell in love, and I went to Bridie and I said, you need to trust me here. Like, this is something. I know that we've been listening to these things that really work for the film, but whatever happened to Stella last week, this completely changes the film. And I think it really took form, especially because we were having trouble with our opening scene and trying to find, like, how do we set the tone for the film right off the jump? And Stella came up with something that was dark and tribal, and I think set the tone for how spooky the film could be, even though it's kind of a comedy. And that was it. I just to speak on the tribal aspects of it, it was unique because we used all these tribal Apache drums that we wanted to bring up anytime Clara was being teased or ultimately possessed by the ghost in the film. It definitely shaped the tone of certain scenes. Even if we were trying to play a little heavier on the comedy, it allowed the audience to know that, like, you're also supposed to be scared, even though there's a couple lines in here that are making you laugh.
I think that's important in color as well, when you get to hear the mix and see what music is being used. They were sending us tracks that the composer had made while we were grading, and it was a big impact to see how much a scene shifts with color. Like, something that might be a little heavy-handed when you're grading it without the music might fit well when the music is strong, because it helps amp that up even more if the director wants that kind of mood. And then the opposite can equally be true. That was an important part of color as well.
Interesting. So the one more thing I want to, maybe that the colors can speak to, people listening to this on No Film School, there's all kinds of levels of people's experience. But if you're sort of a filmmaker starting out, you may have edited your own stuff and done little things, but there's a lot of people who haven't even got to the point where they've had a colorist do anything. Can you just speak, you know, what's like the basic process from the editor to you guys? What, you know, can you break that down for people that haven't actually reached the point where they've had the privilege to work with a colorist and they are just tweaking things in whatever program they have?
Yeah, I don't know if this is like what I have to say is a direct answer to that, but I guess like the sort of the piece of advice that I would throw out there as more of a warning to people in that situation is that, you know, Sam said earlier sort of jokingly about like do no harm, you know, and that sort of is this like fundamental thing I think to keep in mind with color, especially in the sort of entry level and like starting to dabble around with things, and is that it's really easy to really destroy something. And I've seen a lot of micro budget projects where filmmakers have decided to like do their own little thing in Premiere or whatever. And, you know, it's a lot of times it's really easy to make things worse. You know, and that one of the things that we do as colorists is that's the hardest is to maintain a naturalism, and that, you know, you're sort of you're discovering the beauty that's already in the footage, right? I mean, 90% of the time, once in a blue moon, you're in a weird position where you're creating something that's totally different and not there, but most of the time you're finding what is there. And that's kind of goes against the instinct that a lot of people have about like, oh, here I have all these tools and I can just like, what if we put blue into the blacks and now we'll put some green in the midtones and orange and like I can start drawing shapes and, you know, like doing things with the curves. And that's not a good way to do anything. You know, that I think it's really helpful for people that are starting to get into things to keep the less is more mantra like very close to their heart. And that, you know, I also think that for me personally, like when I'm approaching color, I sort of separate things into two boxes of things that I'm doing to the image that are within the realm of like physical plausibility, and then things that are sort of like a film stock type look, right? So when you change the exposure of a shot, or you're relighting, you're changing the color temperature to be warmer or cooler. All of those things are things that could have happened in camera, right? Like that. It's perfect, you know, maybe the exposure is a little under, maybe you want to put a little bit more light on your main character, but you're doing things that are sort of within the realm of physical plausibility. And then there's like a separate box that you're doing things that are more in line with like a creation of a film stock, where maybe there is like a little bit of blue in the blacks, or there's a, you know, a little bit of an interesting way that the midtones work, or you know, it's you're creating like something that emulates a Fuji film stock or whatever. And those things, that box of things, I think you have to mentally keep them a little bit separate, and you don't want to be creating new looks on a shot by shot basis, right? You don't want to be like the first scene shot of a scene have put a little bit of cyan into the midtone, and then, you know, in the second shot, you're doing something different. And if you're just going from shot one to shot two to shot three and like opening up this enormous tool set and starting to like stab at it, it's going to be a disaster, right? So my kind of advice to people in that situation would be, A, maybe don't do it at all. Like less time with someone that has experience doing color is probably better than like trying to do it yourself, which is, it hurts for me to say that since I'm such a believer in the DIY spirit. And like we were talking about kind of like jumping into like teaching yourself a craft, or even if you are interested in learning it, you know, maybe finding an experienced colorist and working with them and asking them, are there any parts of the process that I could do myself? Their answer will probably be no. But that would be a sort of a better approach than just like, you know, I mean, I can't tell you how many small projects I've seen where they've, you know, they're like, well, we've been like noodling with this thing in Premiere for 6 months, and it's like, could you? And it's like, no. Like this is just, yeah.
As an editor that's cut like 7 feature docs, I should never be allowed to use the color tools. It's the, like you can do so much damage. I can totally attest to that. You go down this hole that it's very hard to get yourself back out of. It's
right. Yeah.
So much respect for colorists.
And the tools that are available too in editorial are not necessarily like the tools that I would want to give an editor. You know, if editorial was working in a color managed pipeline, like I think it would be great if they had like a exposure adjustment, right? Or even a color temperature adjustment, and could just say, oh, this shot is like maybe a stop under. Let's just bump it up. Like that's a reasonable thing to want to do. But when an editor or someone starts like noodling around in the 3-way color corrector, it's like, this is like trouble, right? So yeah, I don't know if that's,
I was going to say from the editing side of things, I deal with this a lot as well, because I think that because technology is so readily available and user friendly that most of all filmmakers know enough to be dangerous. And so from editorial side, because I'm not a colorist in any way, and I try to stay out of that because I believe that certain jobs are for certain people, and that's what they're good at that for that. But yeah, I do occasionally run into the director who recut a scene in Premiere or Final Cut and wants you to take a look at it and do it his way and things like that. And or titling, not so much on color, but like just, you know, messing around with graphics and titles, and then you see what they came up with and you're like, I think you should spend some money on the right person to be doing that. But yeah, it's I think great filmmakers are those that know who to be collaborative and hire people for the right reasons, because you don't hire somebody that comes well regarded or referred and then, you know, tell them to push the buttons. You need to put a little bit of trust in them at least.
I want to talk, add to what Nat was saying about tools, and also what Patrick said about having all these tools available. Seth, what platform do you work on?
Resolve.
Okay. Nat and I both work on DaVinci Resolve. DaVinci Resolve is a free download, or for a whopping $300, it is a full studio download, the full version. Anybody could do that. You could buy a $300 little Ripple panel. It's not that big, and you could have a trackball and move things around and interface the software for under $1,000. That is great, okay, but it's like having a Formula One race car and not knowing how to shift the gears. Like you can sit in it, you could start it,
you could push it,
but do you know how to navigate the hairpin turns? Do you know how to get to the finish line? And that's where experienced colorists can do that. That I have been doing this more than I want to say, longer than I have to say. I know how to match shots in my sleep. Mm-hmm. You know, I know how to, like, from going to scopes or whatever technique is. And while these things are free or inexpensive, the amount of time and love and money that you put into a project, you it's like a gift wrapping. You're not going to just, it's like slipping it into a gift bag with this tissue paper, like, here's my film. You know, if you had somebody, a professional, gift wrap it for you, then it's a lot, it looks a lot better when it's sitting under the Christmas tree. I just pulled that analogy out of thin air. Maybe it's all the snow that's around me and all the evergreens. That
we just have a very North Pole vibe here.
Yeah.
Yeah, find the money for a good colorist if you can. It's just make such a difference.
I was on Luster first. Well, first of all, actually, I worked on an actual DaVinci, you know, with Telecine when I first was learning. So when I got into digital, I learned on Luster, which is an Autodesk product. And I found it very confining. I color, great, but I couldn't do a lot of other stuff. And then all of a sudden, I jumped on Resolve, and I was like, whoa, this is so intuitive, and this is kind of fun, and like, I love this. And it was just like version 8, so that we couldn't do anything. And I just couldn't stop. And I had, you know, people would give me QuickTimes, and I could work on a QuickTime, and I didn't have to worry about DPX trans. Like, I really dove into this tool. The thing is, I already had an aesthetic. I knew what a good image looked like. I knew how to get a good looking image. And these were just tools to help me get there in a different way and improve upon that. And so I think anybody who wants to color their own project or learn how to be a colorist or a post-production professional and know a little bit about color, there's so many demos out there. Techniques and LUTs that you could download, but you really need to understand the aesthetic that goes into a good looking image, and look at art, look at photography. These are the things that I get as references from cinematographers or directors. I'm constantly looking at references to paintings and to some fashion photography or photography. And that is what we use as a common reference for what is beautiful or what is artistic and what helps tell a story and something tangible. And understand things like contrast and saturation, the way flesh tones look, and figure out the tools to get that, just the basics. You're dealing with additive light principles, red, green, and blue, and the mixture of red, green, and blue. And if you start on that foundation, which is how I started, just balancing dailies, you start and understand how red, green, and blue interact together, and how contrast can play a part, and color saturation can play a part. And then once you get the basics down, then you could worry about your curves or your windows or your LUTs. Anything that creates sort of a style or helps improve upon it, but you have to have a foundation. Challenge yourself to match shots. There's so many times that I work on TV shows or movies where they shot a first half of the scene in the morning, and then they broke for lunch, and then the light changed when they covered it, and you have to match that, or else, because when everything's cut together, you have to have the flow so it feels like it's happening in real time. And if you don't know how to do that, it doesn't make a difference what kind of crazy LUT that you put on, or look, I put a window on their face. It means nothing. You have to make the experience enjoyable for the viewer, or proper for the viewer. And something like matching shots is like so technical, but it's so essential to the part of color correction and the color grading process that you unless you practice that, you can't. There is nothing within Resolve. Well, that's not true. They have an auto color correct, but doesn't know how to match aesthetically. It will just look at the average of a shot and kind of like, all right, well, this is how it matches up with the average light values and color values of this shot. And it never lines up.
Yeah, all the intention out of the image that the DP had. Yeah.
So you have to, if you really want to advance and learn this, you start, have a good foundation of aesthetics and technique, and then build upon that. And
And sorry, just to add to that, I think lift gamma gain is your friend, and people will get... Like, we have the advanced panel, of course, like you guys, and there's so many buttons on it and controls, but most of your time is spent with your hands on those three controls. And just adjusting that and not spending too long on each image will get you much better results than like diving into a Pandora's box of problems where you're like tweaking one shot way too much and then nothing else can possibly ever match it. Because you're making a beautiful still, but it's not going to play well, or you're not going to see how anything goes in sequence.
Well, super fascinating.
Can I add one thing? To that, which is just that I think just on the same less is more thing, I think that's something that's like always interesting to kind of keep in mind is like I sort of point out to people all of the great films that they love historically that were done photochemically without access to any of the controls that we have today, right? There's no ability to adjust the curves. There's no saturation. There's no contrast. You know, there's, you're adjusting exposure and luminance. Exactly. Right. And so if you think about like, well, what are the films that you love, and like, what are your like top 10 films that you like think are just incredibly beautiful? You know, I think for a lot of people, those are going to be films that were created without access to any of the controls for manipulation that we have today. So yeah, I think that's sort of it's just something that's good to kind of, I don't know. I think it's interesting and useful for people to keep in mind if they're thinking like, oh, I can't really create a, like it must be like, colors must be using all these crazy controls that are like so complicated, and you know, you can't create something beautiful without those. It's just something that I think is kind of good to keep in mind.
And you're hiring a colorist for having that 10,000 hours plus of experience,
and
the taste that goes into it. Like, you've been staring at those images forever. You're constantly referencing photography or, you know, fashion, like Sam said. And you have like a Rolodex in your brain of different looks, and then you just do it instinctively because you just know the panel and you know the controls, and you don't have to look down. You just execute it, and then turn
around, color with the speed of
the director, and hope you're headed the right direction. You know,
yeah.
Just adding on to what you guys are saying, like one of the decisions we had during the animation process was like, you know, I mean, everything was done with crayons and paper. It was very traditional in that way. What would happen is like I would draw different layers and then assemble them in Photoshop, and then take each still and throw it into Premiere. And then we would kind of do this test of like, does the animation work? Does it feel right? Jeremiah like was very insistent about like us taking it a step further. We ended up printing everything that I had, you know, done in Photoshop, and then photographing it in a dark room under a light table. And there was like this texture that came through the paper. And we spent so much time just like playing around with different textures. Like we would tape up the paper to a window, see if like natural light was interesting. We oiled the paper at some point, because that brings out texture in a lot of ways. And and at some point, you know, I was like, well, we can probably manage all of this in Premiere in some way. Like I can add like a jitter to the position of the paper to make it feel like there's a slight difference in registration from still to still. I can slap on a photograph texture on top of the Photoshop, and I can, you know, mimic all of these things. And he was very insistent that we just like do it in the most laborious possible way. And, but ultimately, like, he was so right. Like, there was something so natural and tangible about just doing that, and that was essential to making it feel like it was really, we were in the room with you know, Jonah, and while these things were coming alive, or it just felt very tangible, and I think that was an essential quality to the animations. Seth did something that was rad to the animations. I mean, the coloring that you did with them was awesome, but there was this one thing, there's this one moment where there's like fireflies that come out of a character's eyeballs, essentially. And the yellow that I used, the crayon, was like sort of dull. And Seth was able to like kind of make it feel slightly like it was glowing a little bit more, but not fake. You know, there was a very fine line there. And I think that made that animation stand out so much more, in my opinion. So yeah, it was rad.
There's so much talent at this table. It has been such an honor to talk to all of you today and hear about your process and hear about how you take all these films and just bring them to life. I guess since we're winding down, the last thing that maybe I could ask is if all of you would think of like one line of advice you would give to people listening to this, wanting either to get into what you're into or just in general for the artist storytelling, what line of advice would you have for them?
I think I have something. It's like, be willing to give up a really good paying job for a really crappy paying job in the world you want to be in. And you might have to do it over and over, but it can pay off.
Nice.
To piggyback off of that, for sure, I think that take risks, network with people. And don't be afraid to take a free job if you have to, because I'm here right now because I, you know, had a roommate who asked me if I could come help him out on a short film that he was shooting for 2 days for $100 a day. And I only ended up getting $100 even. And for 2 days, I shot this short film with this director and this producer. And at the end of the shoot, I gave the producer my card and said, if you need anybody to edit this film, let me know. And a couple months later, she contacted me unhappy with the edit they had and asked me to take a look at it. And I recut it. And that film was Affections, directed by Bridie Elliott. And it went to Sundance. And then we made her feature film. And that's the only reason I'm here right now, is because I gave Sarah Winchall my card.
I guess we're going in order. By the way, this is not a round table. It's rectangular. I just, people can't see that, but it really kind of threw me when we sat down at the round table and it's rectangular. So my advice, and I usually tell young filmmakers or people wanting to start out in post-production, is this. The most important job that I have ever worked on is the one I'm working on right now. And anytime I'm on a project, that's the kind of attitude I have, is that everything I did up to that point and everything I'm going to do is based upon this project that I'm working on. And so I don't phone anything in. I don't look forward to the next. I have to be in it. So if you have a temp job, or you're freelance, or if you're working on something you feel, you know, is not really right for you, just give it your passion, give it your all. And it will only help build your spirits and help build your reputation. And I worked graveyard shift for 7 years straight, okay? And man, if every, you know, syncing audio or doing dailies, and if everything was perfect, like I didn't think of it as oh, what am I going to do? It's like everything, I put everything into it. And I still do. So just be in the moment and really, really focus on what you have in front of you and work forward in building your career, and always have that attitude.
Yeah, all this advice, it's turning out to be pretty daunting. but yeah, I agree and would tag on to everything that everyone else has said, that it's not easy at all. You know, yeah, there's like some glamour associated with making films, I suppose, with people that don't have experience actually doing it. It's really hard. And to go along with that, I would say, you know, make sure that you really want to do it, and that you actually find the thing that you're hoping to do interesting. You know, so with color, you know, or something like that, I would say, like, you know, make sure that you actually enjoy doing it, because if you don't, you know, there's no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. You know, there's the reward is the doing it, right? And so if the doing it isn't making you happy, then it's probably not the right thing to do. And that, you know, I know a lot of people who end up kind of grinding out hours of things, thinking that they're working toward, you know, some sort of holy grail on the horizon. And that's not to say that you don't work your way up, because I think, you know, all of us have done that, and that's the way that it goes. But that you have to also be interested and enjoy doing what you're doing along the way to be able to have that attitude that Sam's saying, like, what I'm doing right now is the most important thing. Like, you can't really be looking forward to thinking like, ugh, I hate doing what I'm doing right now, but like, there's some theoretical thing on the horizon that's going to be great. It's like, no, you know, like, and you know, I'm always like stunned by the number of people that I talk to that are trying to get into color that don't actually seem to have that much interest in photography and, you know, images, painting, like the way the light works, and are more sort of mesmerized by either the technology of it or something like that. And so, yeah, you know, you have to, it seems obvious, but you have to be interested in what it is that you want to do, to have that passion for it. So yeah.
I was lucky enough to have mentors, like people I worked for, I was able to learn from what just watching what they are doing. And I think it's a little harder these days in a digital editing world. But I think even if you're an assistant, make a point to spend some time with the editor, watch what they're doing. And if I have an assistant sitting in my room, I tend to explain what I'm doing. And that's just one way to learn the craft. And I think that's very important. And watch tons of movies.
It's so hard to go at the end of this.
Did everyone else take your answers already?
I'll go first with saying I was going to say all the good things you guys did. I would say really good advice is be present and always, like Sam was saying, work hard on whatever you have in front of you. And don't do it expecting some kind of reward. Do it for the work itself, to become better at it. Each time you work, your intention is to make it better. When you're collaborating with other people, expect that they're working their best too. Don't think anyone's trying to cheat you or trying to like pull some kind of different look over you. You know, they're collaborating with you and trying to help you do what you want to do. And my other advice would be, when you do find collaborators, you know, you don't have to have a ton of money to find a colorist that's a professional. I have assistants and they do, you know, lower budget jobs sometimes. And that's how they learn and build relationships. And they have more experience than most people in color, you know. And don't be afraid of letting other people show you what they think your film could be, because you're a little blind to it at a certain stage, and be accepting of their advice. And if they're wrong, that's fine. You can tell them. My last bit of advice would be, if you make a mistake, admit to it and fix it right away. Don't start arguing with people. Just like fix it and move on, you know, and get back to what you're supposed to be doing.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I agree with that. Like, I'm a pretty solitary person creatively. This is like the first time I've ever collaborated in a creative environment with anyone. And everybody that was on board was just so, so great, so talented. Jeremiah was so trusting with me. I think like, yeah, being, I'm a very matter of fact person when it comes to like, sharing ideas. You know, if you don't like something that I've expressed to you, I won't take offense to it at all if you think it sucks. And that was definitely happening. You know, like when I started doing the animatics for the animation, you know, Jeremiah was definitely a little bit sensitive to the way that he was trying to express, you know, changes or you know, whether or not he liked something. And I just told him right off the bat, like, if you think this sucks, like, I won't take offense. You know, I'm here to make this vision come true. And I think ultimately, like, our back and forth was really, really healthy for that reason. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Just to, yeah. And that's one of the reasons that there's three of us here from We the Animals, is because Jeremiah is one of those directors that's like a super glue, you know, and like everyone's stuck to the project and like can't extricate themselves from it until it's perfect. And that's a testament to his personality and who he is as a person, and why everyone on the team has been so crazy and dedicated to it at godforsaken hours, you know. But yeah
definitely. I mean, Jeremiah is an incredible leader in that respect, and the producers too, like Christina and Jeremy, were so encouraging throughout the process. I definitely came into it a little bit insecure because I'd never done animation before, and you know, those things really, really helped make this project come to fruition. So yeah.
Good to have a great team.
Yeah, totally.
Well, thanks everyone. This has been awesome. And this was the No Film School podcast on post-production at the 2018 Sundance Film Festival. Thank you. I mean, rectangular table.
Make sure to check out part one of this conversation if you haven't already. Stay tuned for Indie Film Weekly. Subscribe and rate us on your preferred podcast platform. And as always, thank you for listening.